Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Macramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. It was another busy week in terms of trades, with the July 31st trade deadline rapidly approaching. So many trades have been made thus far, we can't possibly discuss them all, so we'll just run through some of the biggest moves made by contending teams. The Yankees kicked off the trade deadline flurry by acquiring Zach Britton from the Orioles in return for three minor league pitchers, Dylan Tate, the Orioles' ninth-ranked prospect, Cody Carroll, their 15th-ranked prospect, and Josh Rogers. They also bolstered the rotation, adding Jay Happ, ascending infielder Brandon Drury, and an outfielder Billy McKinney to the Jays.
Also adding to their starting rotation were the Red Sox and the Cubs. The Sox traded for Nathan Eovaldi, who is making his first start for them today, Sunday. And it's going pretty well so far, as he has gotten the first out of the game, which is always a nice bonus. So they sent minor league pitcher Jalen Beeks in return. And much to the annoyance of many Phillies fans, the Cubs added Cole Hamels. The Astros have made two trades thus far, acquiring reliever Ryan Pressly from the Twins and catcher Martin Maldonado from the Angels.
The Brewers acquired Mike Moustakas from the Royals in exchange for two minor leaguers, outfielder Brett Phillips and pitcher Jorge Lopez. They also added Joaquin Soria from the White Sox to their bullpen. The Diamondbacks acquired Eduardo Escobar from the Twins, sending in return right-handed pitcher Yoan Duran, and outfielders Ernie De La Trinidad and Gabriel Maciel. And they also added the Rays' Matt Andrias to their bullpen. I probably just said all of those names wrong, but what else is new on this show?
I think you got every name but Matt Andrias right, because I can't even pronounce that.
Yeah.
So which contending team so far has done the best job of addressing needs?
I think they've all done a pretty decent job so far. Obviously, the Yankees, if these pitchers kind of turn out for them, have done a good job of addressing two of their biggest concerns, although we'll see if they have more concerns in the future. I also think the Astros have done a fair job. They got another great reliever who will help contribute to the bullpen, which is already one of the best in baseball. So that will continue to be a huge strength for them going forward.
I think that the Brewers' moves made a lot of sense for them. They were having issues with the power and just general production from their middle infielders. And acquiring Moustakas, obviously, being a third baseman, doesn't help with that. But what it means is that Travis Shaw shifts over to second base. And so immediately it's like, hey, more production in the middle infield. So that was kind of a creative solution to that issue. And, you know, most contending teams need some sort of rotation help. So Soria was a good addition in that regard.
Yeah, and I think that it makes sense that the Cubs added Cole Hamels with their current rotation woes, which is like, you look at their starting rotation and you're like, is this the same Cubs team that was competing? Like, what? And then, like, obviously, guys like Tyler Chatwood are not doing as... I mean, I guess you could say that it's still better than expected, but not much better. So it just makes sense that they added some starting rotation depth there. And I would not be surprised if they make more moves in that direction. I feel like there's still a lot of teams that are going to be addressing starting rotation things, because this is baseball and apparently starters are what a couple of contending teams need.
I mean, you can never have too many starting pitchers, I think, is the philosophy that underlines, you know, a lot of Major League Baseball, specifically at the trade deadline.
It's true, especially since you don't know who's going to get injured and who's going to need time to, like, extra time to start. Also, nobody wants to be the Tampa Bay Rays.
Yeah, although everybody wants their players. They have really just sent a lot of them, except for Chris Archer, who I believe they are holding hostage. And we need to get some team to get him out of that situation, because I can't imagine what he is going through.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Right now, it's just basically Operation Rescue Tampa Bay Rays pitchers from their pitching staff. So we will see if Chris Archer gets released from the hostage that is the Tropic, that is the Trop.
But also, if they get rid of their pitchers and they're making Sergio Romo play third base, then what is that? What's going to happen? I just, everyone's going to be out of position. Everyone's going to be where they're not supposed to be. And it's just going to somehow be an even bigger mess than it already is down there.
That's true.
So what we're saying is contract the Tampa Bay Rays.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Sorry to any of the Tampa Bay Rays fans who are listening to this. We're just telling you the truth.
I think most of them would probably agree.
That's true.
Not to speak for any Rays fans, but, you know.
We feel for you.
This is coming from a place of sympathy.
It is. Except for a minor bit of glee whenever the Red Sox play them. But, like, you know, we'll just gloss over that.
This is what happens when I'm a fan of an NL team, so...
Good. We have variety here. We've got some NL and some AL. So we've talked about the major leaguers that have been parts of these trades, but what are some of the more intriguing prospects who have been included in these trades? And by what I mean who, because they are people.
Very, very interesting is who the Yankees got. No, not who the Yankees got. The Orioles got. Now that I realize that I said that Dylan Tate was the Orioles' ninth-ranked prospect, that was the Yankees.
He could be their ninth-ranked prospect. We don't know.
Good point. the pitchers that were sent in the Zach Britton deal are very interesting, especially Dylan Tate, who has been, you know, highly ranked in prospect world. I think that, you know, guys like Tate and Cody Carroll have very, very interesting futures ahead of them, but Dylan Tate's always been intriguing. That's really just the most intriguing players on the prospect side. I was also just thinking of the Cardinals trading Sam Tuivalala. I also just really love saying that name. For Mariners prospect Seth Elledge. And Seth Elledge is kind of interesting in that he flew under the radar. He's a fourth round pick in 2017 and has only allowed 5 earned runs this entire season.
Wow.
And he gave up zero earned runs in the months of May and June, and only one was unearned. So, and he's only walked 15 and struck out 54 in 38 and a third innings. So he's probably the most intriguing prospect who is in any of the recent trades so far, just because he's flown well below the radar of a lot of people. So I would say it would be him. And immediately after being traded from High A Modesto, he got promoted to Double A Springfield in the Cardinals system. So we'll see if he makes that jump to Double A. But if he keeps putting up those numbers, I'm not saying that he's going to be like the next greatest bullpen asset, but that's still a pretty solid reliever right there.
It's interesting. I feel like, you know, there's not been a ton of big name prospects that have gone from one team to another in these recent set of trades. You know, I think maybe the biggest name that's been traded so far is Yusmeil Diaz, at least in terms of, you know, the kind of more major trades. But I don't know, maybe it's some of these smaller trades that people aren't really paying attention to where you're really kind of are getting some of the more intriguing prospects.
I'll give a shout out to Jalen Beeks. He is right now one of the best pitchers in the International League. He is only giving up one home run per 9 innings and has a 4.68 strikeout to walk ratio. And he has really demonstrated that he has pinpoint control. He was not great in his few games with the Red Sox this season. He pitched 9.2 innings and gave up 17 runs, which is not what you want. But he, at least in the minor leagues, has proven that he can be an incredibly effective pitcher, and the Rays need those. So we'll see if they can get him to transition into the major leagues more effectively than the Red Sox did. And the Rays do have a history of having great pitching.
It's just that that time is not right now. So hopefully they can develop that there. And yeah, one of the things that I've noticed with International League players is that making that jump from Triple A to the major leagues is very, very difficult in many regards, just because the different parks that they play in have different factors, and not just like outfield dimensions and all of that, but also just like weather factors and the types of players that they see. So like while Triple A can have like a guy who just keeps hitting dingers, it's not like the most common thing, and just making those adjustments is one of the most important things for prospects. And hopefully he'll be able to have a successful career with the Rays, but we'll see.
Well, now there are 2 days left until the trade deadline hits. There's definitely going to be some more moves between now and when the actual deadline rolls around. So what are our predictions for what's going to happen? And are they definitely going to happen right as soon as we stop recording?
To get to the second question, yes, definitely.
Yes.
As for the first, I think the Pirates have to do something to address both the starting pitching and the bullpen if they want to continue this little run of success that they've had in the past 3 or so weeks. So I think they definitely have to do something there. The Red Sox might look at, some infield players who could play second base or third base, give them a boost, particularly since Rafael Devers landed on the DL yesterday. They don't expect it to be serious, but he has struggled a little bit, particularly defensively this season. So that is a move that would not be too surprising for them to make.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that are just going to... There's so many teams that have so many needs, and then there are teams who a lot of people thought would be contenders are not contenders. I think the one that would be the most intriguing is whether or not the Nationals do sell at the deadline, considering that they haven't really lived up to expectations for the NL East, and then there's the Phillies and the Braves, and then everyone's just like looking at the NL East going, is that the Phillies? But so I think it'll be interesting to see if the Nationals sell. I think they might sell some less impactful. They'll make some less impactful moves, but it'll still be something. I think that the Rays have a good shot of finally releasing Chris Archer into the wild of MLB. One can only hope. And I think there's just going to be a lot more big name prospects going to be moved, probably starting after we record.
Yes, that is almost definitely the case. I'll say, I think we've seen probably the bigger trades. I think Machado was the biggest name that was out there, and obviously that's already happened. Hamels was probably the top line starter that was available. That's arguable, obviously, for various reasons, but nonetheless, he's already been moved. So at this point, we've got Chris Archer available, obviously. We'd very much like to see that happen, but, we'll see whether or not it actually does. Matt Harvey is another name that's been thrown around a lot, and the Reds have made it very clear that he's auditioning, essentially, to be traded right now, so would not be surprised to see him on the move. Still some big-name relievers who could be going somewhere. Brad Brock, Kirby Yates, both guys who don't really serve that much of a purpose with their current teams and could bring in a nice little prospect haul for them. So, yeah, not saying any of them necessarily will get traded, but I guess those are the ones that I'll kind of be paying attention to just because they're some of the more intriguing names that are left. But I'll, yeah, it's also, I guess, important to remember that teams, especially in recent years, don't seem to be holding themselves quite so much to this particular deadline. It's more the waiver wire deadline that seems to kind of have some of the bigger surprise trades. So, yeah, there'll be some more auction in the next 2 days, but it's not going to be it for transactions this season.
All right. Along with the trades, there have been a number of injuries this week, some of which could impact this July 31st trade deadline and the waiver wire deadline. So the Mets finally decided to allow Jonas Cespedes to have season-ending surgery on both heels, which carries an 8 to 10 month recovery time. Yankees catcher Gary Sanchez is out at least until late August, landing on the DL on Tuesday with an aggravated groin injury. So he did have an excuse for not, you know, quote unquote, hustling during that game. Aaron Judge also landed on the DL this week. Is expected out for at least 3 weeks with a small fracture in his wrist. The Pirates' Corey Dickerson and Josh Bell are both on the DL, Dickerson with a strained left hamstring and Bell with a strained left oblique. Neither of those are expected to be overly serious, but you can never really tell with strains. And then finally, the Cubs' Chris Bryant headed to the DL with a left shoulder inflammation. And this is just weeks after returning from the DL for the same injury. There is currently no timetable for his return, but he and the team are both pretty hopeful that he will play again this season. So which injury will impact the team the most?
I mean, Judge and Bryant are both two big name players on teams with pretty deep lineups. So even though those are both teams that are in contention, I don't think that those will be the I don't think those will have as much of an impact as maybe the Pirates injuries. That's a team. We'll talk about the Pirates a little bit more in a moment. But as we mentioned, they've had a lot of recent success, and that's mostly been on the strength of their offense. So I think losing to parts of their lineup is going to be a bit of a blow for a team that has just kind of recently surged back into possibly contending. It's not ideal. I think teams that you know, maybe have more weak spots don't have as much wiggle room when it comes to injuries. So I'm going to say the Pirates are the most in trouble with the recent injury news.
Yeah, just looking through the entire list of injuries, and one, I just want to wrap them all up in bubbles. Two, you know, on, like, when you're reading it offhand, you're just like, oh my God, Gary Sanchez and Aaron Judge and Chris Bryant. But I think as far as impact goes, I'd have to agree that it would be Corey Dickerson and Josh Bell being the most ones who will be missed the most just because of the impact that they would have on the Pirates.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although I will say that Gary Sanchez will probably have a significant impact because it's always difficult for a team when their primary catcher, lands on the DL for such a long time because there is so much lost in terms of, rapport with the pitching staff that will have to be kind of made up a little bit.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Now, since we've talked about the Pirates some, let's talk about the Pirates some more. They recently strung together an 11-game winning streak, and they've taken 15 of their last 18 games. As of recording, they are 6 games back of first in the NL Central, and probably more relevantly, are 3 games back of the second NL wildcard spot. What's been the key to this turnaround, and can they keep it going long enough to grab that wildcard spot?
So the key to the turnaround has certainly been an insane offensive run for some of their best players, like Corey Dickerson. I think over the past month has been hitting close to 400, and a bunch of their other players, like Josh Bell, are right around the 350 mark. So it's just kind of a lot of ridiculously well-timed overproduction in terms of the offense.
Yeah, I would have to agree that for the Pirates. Just so much is going right in terms of timing. I mean, just looking at the recent statistics and like how many runs that they've been scoring compared to how many they've been giving up. That run differential is like, it's a lot of runs. But I think the fact that between their pitching being solid and their offense just completely going out there and driving in the runs, I think it's just been a combination of everything going right at the right time.
Yeah, very much so. The offense has been more than doing its job. During the 11-game winning streak, they outscored their competition 84-33. So that kind of speaks to the run differential thing that you brought up, Jen. And the pitching, it's been, you know, certainly good enough to back it up. So far in the second half, the starting rotation is fourth in baseball in ERA and fairly deep into games. And the bullpen has been getting its job done, too, for the most part. Still, overall, some issues with both the rotation and the bullpen that, you know, if the Pirates do want to seriously make a run for it, they're going to have to address. But nonetheless, I think it's kind of a surprise to everyone that they're as in it as they are right now, given how poorly they performed earlier in the season. So that in itself is got to be a pleasant surprise for Pirates fans. But yeah, they're definitely in it at this point, that a wild card in the National League is really going to be up for grabs amongst a lot of teams. So yeah, just going to be curious to see if the Pirates can keep it up.
Yeah, I hope they can, just because they seem like they're a fun team, and it's always it makes the last bit of the season a lot more intriguing and fun to watch when there are so many teams in the mix.
Yeah, I just feel like the wild card race in general has just been like some of the most thrilling races in recent years, and also the wild card games itself being like the most like high pressure situation that a team would want to get in. But for a viewer, it's just like all adrenaline to watch, which I would assume would be kind of the same, but it's just going to be very interesting to see because there are so many teams that are close to the wild card. Like looking at it right now, the Brewers are ahead by 2.5 games. Arizona's right there. Colorado's just a half game back. Braves are a game and a half back. Pirates are 3 games back. Cardinals are 4 games back. Nationals are 5 games back, but there's still about 2 months of baseball left, so it's going to be a very tight race.
Yeah, if you like exciting, tight playoff races, look more toward the NL than the AL this year.
We all love the spectacle of the position player pitching, but the event is becoming increasingly frequent. Over 40 position players have pitched in a game this season, over 30 of whom have done so since June 1st, both of which are records. Has the increase made the event less special?
I mean, Kike Hernandez pitching, that's going to be exciting to me regardless of anything else. Maybe it shouldn't be because I think he was like the third player ever to go 0-for-7 and also pitch in a game. And he was also the first position player to ever give up a walk-off home run. So may have actually been the saddest example of a position player pitching ever. But nonetheless, it's Kike Hernandez. Anything he does is going to have some joy in it. So
also his reaction to what he did, he was just like, okay, it's like true Kike Hernandez form.
Yeah, I thought it would help in contract negotiations, but so much for that. His words, not mine.
So good.
But obviously, that's just one example. I guess as a whole, I think that, you know, for an individual watching it, just watching their team, I don't think it's necessarily less special. I think there's still is sort of an excitement of, oh, that guy's pitching? What? That's nuts. Maybe, you know, for the rest of us, we're less inclined to be like, oh, wow, a position player is pitching for a team that I don't usually watch. You know, I think in that regard, it's maybe less special. You know, there's maybe less of a, for people who aren't actually following that particular team, like we might not care as much anymore. But yeah, I guess when it comes to just, you know, people watching players from their own team, I think that's not going to change.
Yeah, I think it's always going to be special and a spectacle when, you know, a few certain players like Kike Hernandez pitch, just because more so of the player than of the fact that it's a position player pitching. But I think overall it has kind of lost its awe a little bit, particularly when you get into players you know, that don't carry the same clout as Kike Hernandez, or, you know, as Ichiro when he pitched. So I think that overall it's definitely an event that is becoming far less noteworthy.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think, I mean, the act of a position player pitching is always going to be some kind of a spectacle. That being said, I don't think that it's going to lose any type of specialness. I think it's just going to be special for a lot of different reasons now. You know, like you both said about how it's just going to be like, oh, it's that guy pitching? Okay. So it's more just going off of who is pitching, not really, oh my God, it's a position player. So, like, Anthony Rizzo pitched, Pablo Sandoval pitched, Kike Hernandez, which is arguably the best one of all of them. I think that's becoming my brand now, is defending Kike Hernandez at all costs, which I am okay with. But it's just a matter of, like, who it is. And I think that's still bringing an exciting aspect to the game, because it's like, okay, let's see which guy they're going to bring into the bullpen this time.
I just love how long Rizzo spent begging to get into a game, and then as soon as he did, he was just like, I never want to do that again.
And we just got to get it out of their system.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do we think are the causes of this increase in position players pitching?
I think probably, you know, at least a insubstantial amount has to do with the fact that so many games are blowouts, where you have, you know, a few concentrated great offensive teams, and then a bunch of teams whose pitching is really ineffective. And so whenever you have those teams meet each other, you're going to have a lot more blowouts than if there was a little more parity in the league.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. You know, for the most part, when a position player is pitching, it's in games where their team is being blown out. You know, every now and then you have it, like with the case of the Dodgers and Kike Hernandez, where it was the 16th inning and they were just completely out of actual pitchers. Although they had Rachel warming up, but that's a whole other thing. But yeah, for the most part, it is just going to be the fact that you were having a lot more in terms of offensive output. And again, it's the uneven distribution of how that's happening. So whether or not that's a good thing, I think most people would probably argue that it's not great, but I don't know, for fans of the teams that are putting up all the offense.
I am loving it right now.
So precisely.
So what I think is the cause is, to phrase the great Tim Lincecum, paraphrase, juiced ball BS. I think a lot of it does have to do with the ball, and, you know, the ball traveling a lot further than a lot of players and, well, everyone expected. But now that it's kind of becoming the norm, it's just more of like, okay, is there going to be like an even number of like good hitters distributed between teams, which will never be the case. And again, I think pitchers will eventually adjust to whatever is going on with the baseball. It's just that this season is not that time. And I think that there'll probably be a decrease in position players pitching in the future. Again, it's just not that time. And, you know, there's so many different things going into it, but I think, you know, the fact that there are, you know, hitters on certain teams who are like obviously much better than others. And the baseball, I think, is just a combination of factors. And honestly, I would not be surprised if we see more players like Shohei Ohtani getting into professional baseball because they can both pitch and hit.
So on Tuesday, the Mamie Johnson Little League team won the DC Championship, making it the first time an all-black team has done so. The league was created just 4 years ago, and prior to joining it, many of its players had never played baseball or even really thought about playing baseball. In its inaugural season, 120 kids participated, and that number is now over 300. In an interview with NPR, league founder and president Keith Barnes spoke about why there has been a decline in black participation in baseball, saying, "I think it's a multitude of reasons. You know, it's basically the popularity of basketball and football, specifically in this area of DC. And two, baseball is a generational sport. Coming from myself, my father played, my uncles played, my older brothers played, and it was passed down. Another big reason is the cost of youth sports. Basketball, the only thing you need is a basketball, and you can go to a neighborhood hoop." So just how great was it to see the team celebrate its victory with the Nationals?
I think it's huge, you know, to be able to be, you know, a kid playing baseball and then to celebrate with the local big league team. That's incredible. Yeah, and it's, you know, it's just nice to see them be rewarded with that.
Yeah, very much so. It's nice that the impact of this does not seem to be lost on much of anyone. It's, you know, good to see that they're getting recognized for this accomplishment, and, you know, hope to see them keep it up as they head on to the Little League World Series.
So what impact do we think this exposure will have on black youth participation in the sport?
I think it's going to be, it's always going to be an uphill battle, but these are the small victories that are really good to see. I think if they see that, like, okay, black youth can do this. As long as they get the support that they need, they are capable of playing baseball. They're capable of winning championships, especially in big metro areas. And they are capable of going to the Little League World Series. I think it's just, you know, again, it's just representation. And to see this kind of representation with an all-black team winning the DC Championship, it's a start. It's not going to solve everything and why there's been a decline in black players in Major League Baseball, but it is something. And, you know, if we look back in recent years, like, the biggest stories to come out of Little League Baseball is mostly black players, like
Monet Davis.
Yes, that's it, Monet Davis. I was trying to make sure that I had the last name correct, but yes, Monet Davis, you know, black girl, incredible pitcher. You know, just to see that representation, it's good impact.
Yeah, I think if, you know, we look at stories like this and it inspires even a handful of kids who might not have otherwise felt like they had a place in baseball to think otherwise, I think that is a big impact. I also think that maybe it's not just going to be kids who are impacted by it, but hopefully adults and people who can actually, you know, help provide the sort of support and guidance that, you know, a little league needs. I think that's going to be big too. I think, you know, we're going to see people who see this happening, see the success, and be like, okay, this is something that's possible. If these guys can do it, we can do it too. So that, ideally, yeah, we're going to see a lot more in terms of support being given to young black players who are young black kids who may not have otherwise had the resources or the access or the desire even. That'd be the ideal. And I think that we'll see some of that. You know, I don't know how much we'll be aware of it, but this is only going to help things. It's not going to be a step in the other direction.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that any exposure of this nature is going to be helpful in some respect. So I just hope that it kind of comes with, kind of more, financially stable people, contributing in larger ways to these projects. Because I know that there are already people, presumably kind of throughout the country, doing things like Shaquille Taylor does. And raising funds to buy equipment for inner Chicago area Black youth to play baseball. So I think that if anything, we're just going to see more of that, which is definitely a good thing. And I just hope, as you guys have said, that a team named after the first woman pitcher starts to really recruit more young girls to the sport.
Yeah. Definitely agreed. And I was also thinking of Shakia's efforts to help raise money for equipment for Black and Latino youth in inner city Chicago. Just, efforts like that and putting that out on social media and putting the call out there like, hey, these youth need your help. And if you're financially stable and have the expendable money to donate like $5 for equipment, it's a huge thing. So I would encourage a lot of people to keep eyes on that if they're on social media and, if it's possible, donate old equipment, donate some cash, they could really use it.
All right. And for our final topic of the day, changing gears very, very drastically, going from young and not white to old and white. During Saturday's Braves-Dodgers game, the Braves broadcast booth, Joe Simpson and Chip Carey, commented on the Dodgers wearing more casual outfits during BP, pointing out the number of t-shirt wearers and lack of socks on Chase Utley, lambasting them for appearing anonymous to fans and overall unprofessional and an embarrassment. Apparently, according to Simpson, fans won't know who players are without names on the back of their jerseys, because, I wouldn't recognize Justin Turner anywhere, apparently.
Indistinct.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and we'll totally not recognize Chase Utley at all. No.
Yeah, of all teams to like claim that there are players who are not recognizable to fans. I mean, to be fair, it's not like they've had them on TV for like 5 years, but even so. Anyway, in response, Kike Hernandez tweeted an image of a blue Speedo with the Dodgers logo on the front and his name on the back, most importantly. And Justin Turner replied to the tweet asking Kike if he could borrow a pair of Kike's overalls. When Chip Carey took to Twitter to defend the comments, he tried tweeting through it, guys, never do it. Brandon McCarthy replied saying, Chip, it was Chase Utley, the near universal choice for how to conduct yourself as a professional baseball player. At this point, we should also note that Chase's shirt was a K cancer shirt, which benefits Jason Mott's foundation, which goes towards cancer research. So, that just adds another level of cluelessness to this whole thing. The Braves have since sent a word of apology to the Dodgers, and Joe Simpson stopped by the Dodgers clubhouse to speak with Utley, though he didn't get the chance to speak to Dave Roberts. So, at least he made that effort, but, damage already kind of done. Just how old man yells at clouds is this whole thing on the part of Chip and Joe?
Extremely. It's just, like, of all the things that you could, pick apart, in terms of baseball changing or being less professional, like, you choose batting practice and, like, players wearing t-shirts and no socks. Like, who is going to be watching batting practice and notice that Chase Utley isn't wearing socks and, have the thought that Chase Utley is incredibly unprofessional in doing so? Like, it's just such a weird thing to pick out.
Also, socks. Like, what if he just didn't have a clean pair of socks yet that are, like, game appropriate? What if he's, like, wearing those, like, low, no-show ankle socks? Like, come on. This is the most ridiculous thing that I have seen in baseball recently, and it's like, you're going after batting practice attire.
Because
batting practice, okay?
Yeah, I mean, I know people in baseball love their high socks, but like, come on, it's not the game, it's practice. Literally right there in the word, it's practice. So it's just of all things to be working oneself into a tizzy over, and not even just like making an offhand comment, but like doing what was essentially a prepared and planned segment. Like they literally had to like get footage of the batting practice, have it cut, have it ready to go so that Joe Simpson and Chip Carey could provide this super necessary commentary. It's just, I can't imagine that level of mad to put in that level of effort over this, but
Also the fact that it's like, the thing about batting practice is like, it's after many hours of these players working out, putting in, you know, their reps at weight machines and whatever, and then like batting practice is a way for them to like get loose on the field and get their body into the right physicality to swing a baseball, to field ground balls, to catch fly balls. It's just preparing themselves for the game, and why wouldn't they be doing it in a way that makes them comfortable? Also, the fact that like the way that they dress at batting practice is also kind of a team bonding thing in some ways. Like Chase Utley wearing a Kate Cancer shirt, and like Kike Hernandez has been tweeting out about the shirt before. And like, it's not uncommon to see players wearing shirts that are comfortable for them. You know, it's like, it's part of the camaraderie of baseball that like, oh, let's just do what we want at batting practice because it's comfortable. It's practice.
Yeah. So I think we have established now that Simpson and Carey were being pretty ridiculous. I think for the most part, everyone agrees.
They were the definition of mad online.
Yes, even though they were mad on air. yeah, and like to the credit of Braves fans, like I think most of them like kind of don't care for their broadcast team. And I know this is generalizing, but I have seen more criticism from Braves fans of their broadcast team and of this particular thing than defending it. So based on that anecdotal experience, I think it's been established that, you know, they were way out of line. But that said, why do broadcasts continue to trot out announcers who spend a large portion of the game talking about how much worse today's incarnation of baseball is?
It's just like, I don't understand. I really don't know what, like if like who is listening to the broadcasts, and you know, if they just think that getting these big name, you know, former players or, you know, longtime broadcasters is going to get a lot of people to tune in. I don't know. Like you're not going to appeal to, you know, prospective fans, particularly when this sort of stuff always circulates social media, and that's going to be a lot of people's introduction to this broadcast booth, to these teams. Like, it just does not make sense to me.
I just feel like it's a lot of going with a status quo. You know, retired player, person who has some kind of a legacy with broadcasting or baseball or something. And there's just a lot of nepotism and favoritism when it comes to who is in the booth. And I don't like it. It's an unfair advantage for those guys. And then for the viewer and the listener, it's just like, it's these guys? And like, I have begun to make it a point that if I'm not at a major league game, like, I am not going to listen, or like I will put the games on mute if I have to and just watch without sound, because these broadcasters recently are not the best, and there are so many better options. And I have many feelings about this in general, but baseball just also needs to do better on the broadcasting front. Please get like 5 million Jenny Kavnars out there, please.
Yeah, I think the problem with broadcasting as an industry, and especially when it comes to sports broadcasting, is there's so little turnover in it. I think when people get these jobs, they hold on to them for basically as long as they can. And I get that, you know, and in the case of, you know, people like Vin Scully or Bob Uecker, like, it's great that you have these guys around for so long who have kind of a sense of the history and, you know, actually like still can provide interesting commentary and insightful commentary. But as so often happens, most people aren't Vin Scully or aren't Bob Uecker. And you do get guys like this who just think that complaining about the game and criticizing players amounts to, you know, useful analysis when it really doesn't. So it's nice when you actually get some kind of young blood in there. Like, it's nice to see like a Joe Davis type, who's an actual millennial, who actually seems excited about the game in there and is not just making it his goal to be critical and to make it a, oh, in my day type thing. And I just think we need more of that, as we've said, you know, more diversity in terms of gender and racial and ethnic representation would always be great. That almost always seems to be helpful, you know, rather than just having basically a really homogenous group, as it kind of always has been. But it's, you know, it's a very slow change, because, as I said, when people get these jobs, they don't want to leave them. So, you know, short of like doing something truly outrageous that leads to one getting fired, you don't see much in the way of involuntary or voluntary turnover. So that's something that you hope we'll eventually be seeing the changes, but again, it could take a long time.
Yeah, and just kind of going off that a little bit, you know, one of the things that I've also seen, just because I've been around a lot of minor league baseball in my life, there are a lot of good and talented broadcasters in the minor leagues right now. And if you haven't already, there's this piece in the New York Times on AAA Omaha's broadcaster Donnie Barnes about what it's like to kind of be stuck at a level after years in the minor leagues trying to get a major league broadcasting gig, but like the most that you're going to get is broadcasting spring training games. And there is just such a lack of turnover in Major League Baseball as far as broadcasters go. And while that is good in some regards, because some of these broadcasters are beloved, like, you're not going to want to see Vin Scully go unless he wants to go. But when you see that there are broadcasters like Joe Simpson and Chip Carey getting these jobs, and then you hear these guys in the minor leagues and their broadcasts are way better than Joe Simpson and Chip Carey, and they're stuck in the minor leagues because where else are they going to go? There's not a lot of turnover in Major League Baseball. And there are a lot of women also coming up through broadcasting in the minor leagues, you know. It's just there are no good opportunities because guys like Joe Simpson and Chip Carey exist.
Speaking of old-timey baseball, we turn to This Week in Baseball History.
Great segue.
A+.
Thank you so much. So we had in this coming week a number of noteworthy Hall of Fame inductions. On July 30th, 2006, 18 people, primarily Negro Leagues players, are inducted into the Hall of Fame, including Effa Manley, the only woman to hold the honor thus far. On August 1st, 1982, Frank Robinson and Hank Aaron, were inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Just 3 years ago, on August 1st, 2015, Clayton Kershaw strikes out Mike Trout looking, marking the first time that reigning MVPs have faced one another in a major league game. Trout went 0-for-3 against Kershaw, so who's really the greatest baseball player, just saying. And the Dodgers also won that one, 3-1.
So throwing it way back out there, and now I'm wondering, like, if there's a way back Wednesday, a flashback Friday, and a throwback Thursday. Why isn't there anything for any other days of the week? Anyway,
Sunday.
What was it?
Send it back Sunday.
All right, let's send it back Sunday. Sending it back to 1921, August 2nd. Members of the 1919 Black Sox team are acquitted of the charges by a jury, but are banned indefinitely from baseball the next day after Commissioner Landis determines there's overwhelming evidence pointing to them fixing the games.
Was there? You be the judge and the jury.
And the executioner.
Yes. I think they're all dead, though.
I hope so.
Yeah, otherwise we have some very decrepit old former baseball players walking around, and that's just sad. They're probably not walking either.
No,
Zombie
they're
Black Sox. Zombie Black Sox.
Halloween costume called it.
Rounding out the week on August 3rd, 1948, after 8 relief appearances, Satchel Paige makes his first major league start, pitching 7 innings to collect the win, one of 28 he acquired in his Hall of Fame career, and he was the first Black player inducted into, or first Negro Leagues player inducted into the Hall of Fame after Ted Williams urged Major League Baseball to do so.
Thank you, Ted Williams, for speaking up about that, because we sure know that most of Major League Baseball wouldn't have done so otherwise. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen Mac Ramos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. And you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.